You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Modern Myth with me, Tristan, the Anarchaeologist, on the Archaeology Podcast Network. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Murray Cook, who's the Archaeologist for Stirling Council. He has written many books, journals, articles, and other things all about the history happening in Stirling. And I think it's a good idea to now talk about, you know, what's kind of going on in the most central city in Scotland. Now, Stirling's quite small. How best would you describe Stirling as a place to somebody who's never been there?
Well, Stirling, yeah, thanks for that, and thanks for the invitation. Stirling is tiny. There are towns bigger than Stirling in Scotland. In terms of a British city, it's tiny. In terms of a global city, it's absolutely small. It was a place that had a great historic significance. Its city status was granted quite recently by the Queen, so it's an indication of its status, its location, its history, as opposed to its size. And I live very close to the city centre, and I can walk 10 minutes into the city centre, and then 10 minutes in the other direction, I can hit the countryside. So, 40 minutes might see you from one end to the other of the city boundaries. So absolutely small. A lovely place, though, full of history and of great significance to Scotland's identity and history.
And I think that's definitely something that we are going to touch on later, because that's actually very much tying into some of the books that you're written and books that are about to come out. But I want to actually just focus on, like, why did you end up in Stirling? You know, what drew you to Stirling? I don't think it was the city status being small. I think there was something more. So what can you tell me about that?
Well, from a personal perspective, it was simply that there was a job available 10 years ago.
Sounds like archaeology all over, doesn't it?
No. I mean, I'd worked in AOC for 13 years. I got made redundant in the crash, tried a couple of years in Lancaster, and then this job came up, and I thought a good opportunity to get back to Scotland and a change. I mean, I'd been doing commercial stuff, and this, of course, is the other side of the fence. This is setting those planning conditions rather than meeting them. So gave it a go, and have never looked back.
Why did you want to do archaeology anyway? Like, don't you know that the conditions are terrible, the pay is awful, and nobody actually knows what you do? I mean, this is the internal information that nobody knows about until they're about 2 years in, and then they finally discover it.
Yeah. Well, again, that's probably a product of my age. I went to uni in the early 90s. I got a grant. Only a small proportion of the population went to university. At the time, the idea was simply get a degree. Once you had a degree, you could do whatever you wanted to do. And literally, the ground changed under my feet. As the first member of my family to go to university. So archaeology sounded fun, but I didn't really know what to do afterwards, fell into archaeology. And I was one of those lucky few that had a degree at the start of the 90s boom, and obviously rode that from subcontractor to commercial director at AOC. And, for 13 years, there was a lot of fun. There was a lot of pressure. Commercial archaeology got harder and harder and harder, I think. I don't envy anybody that's still in it. But if you have fun, if you can have fun in archaeology, I think it's the best job in the world, but it's finding where you can have fun.
I mean, for me For me personally, my journey was very, very mixed. I came into university doing a science degree, and I left with an archaeology degree. That's not a shade on archaeology, by the way. It was chemistry I came in with. But I did change, but I actually changed because I actually found archaeological theory very interesting. That actually was the thing that changed me. I'm wondering, in terms of archaeology at the moment, what parts of archaeology really interest you? Like, what is the kind of the thing about archaeology that's just like other people, they like these kind of time zones, they like this kind of like, oh, I like these kind of artifacts. What's in it for you that really like fires you up?
Well, it's discovery. It's the simple process of discovery. You put a spade in the ground, you find something that no one's seen for 1,000 years, 2,000 years. That's brilliant in and of itself. If you keep doing it and you end up with, you know, one site after another, you can rewrite history or prehistory. Every day is different. I think being outside is fantastic. Archaeology also, and certainly the type of archaeology I've started to do, and I should say that within the kind of council role, I spend a lot of my time, my free time, and my own time, if there are people listening, actually researching archaeology, digging sites, digging nice sites, and actually being outside on a nice site with people that want to be there when there are no timetabling pressures. If we want to take a day, if we want to take a year, if we want to take 5 years, it doesn't matter. As long as, you know, we write it up, we do the post-ex, cover all the costs. But I do as much or as little, and everybody wants to be there. So everybody is having a good time. And if you're having a good time and everybody around you is having a good time, that's a recipe for a long, happy life, as far as I can tell.
And so you've been doing these, I mean, are they kind of like, what are the kind of people that come to these digs that you do? I'm assuming it's not just you by yourself. You know, who do you have that come?
Well, I do two different types of digs. Over the summer, July and August, I do kind of fee-paying field schools. And these get, students through to kind of mature students, people on holiday, people that want to dig, people that want to come back to the profession, people that want to try a day on a dig and see what it's like. But then the rest of the year, in Stirling specifically, I do a mixture of things. I have a kind of ad hoc relationship with a number of students. They do placements with me. We do a mixture of data entry, learning the planning system, and then every now and again, a weekend, a long weekend, we'll dig a site. So I kind of teach them the basics of how to dig, how to write up, what's expected, and it's local volunteers. So people that live in Stirling or within a few miles of Stirling, and you know, I have an email list of upwards of 1,000 names. Various people come along. Sometimes they come for a day. Sometimes they keep coming back, and you build your team on that. We're not doing complicated things, small scale keyhole targeted at the major stratigraphic blocks, trying to get dating evidence. So yeah, very good. All good fun.
I'm quite intrigued in some of your, you're quite active on social media, on the Stirling Archaeology Facebook page. And I'm just wondering what, you know, like, I'll be honest here. A lot of people in archaeology and heritage are not very au fait with the most modern of technologies. I think some people have managed the blog. Obviously, we at the Archaeology Podcast Network have taken over the airwaves. But I think generally there's not really, there's some really good examples of stuff like the Caithness Rock Project. But you, what kind of like, what made you say, right, I need to make a Facebook page about this and I need to maintain it? Like, what were the ideas going behind that?
Well, I should say I'm not at all media savvy. I don't tweet and I don't have Instagram. I mean, Facebook, it's easy. you know, you take a picture of something, you put a little bit of text, you can put a, you put a link to a document, people are interested. I mean, I suppose there is a very much an idealistic position for me. I'm a public servant. I'm employed by the council, by local taxpayers, to promote and protect their past. So, you know, archaeology, that's a hard word. That's a hard word to spell. It's a hard word to pronounce. And there's a definite kind of feeling, or I definitely have a feeling that it's, that for most people, they might say that archaeology is not for them. It's something that, archaeology is not for them. So it's something tricky. It's something that is hard to gain. It's physically hard. It's intellectually hard. So the Facebook seems to me a way of promoting everything that's going on, of actually demonstrating to the public what archaeology is, how much we can learn about the past, how, why archaeology is important. If we want archaeology to be important, we have to have the public on side, and if the public's on, for the public to be on side, they have to understand why it's so wonderful. You know, why is archaeology great? Why is Stirling brilliant? How else do you do that other than show them the evidence?
I'm just wondering, I've noticed on some of the videos, you talk about a secret location that you're digging up. So I'm assuming it's yes. Not just because you're living the kind of like James Bond lifestyle. I'm assuming there's some difficulty with that because of the limitations and the laws that you have to abide by. All the limitations and laws that you have to abide by. What is that secret like thing about? Why is it secretive?
Well, I mean, obviously, in Scotland, the right to roam, or the you know, responsible access, means that you can go anywhere. The difficulty comes when you find that access to a particular location is actually hard, simply because of its nature. Where do you park? Where do you park? How do you get there? And how do you ensure that your research doesn't interrupt the kind of day-to-day activities of a farm? So, you know, a lot of what we do, a lot of what archaeologists do, certainly a lot of what I do, is digging with people's permission. It's not a development issue where they have to clear the land in order for it to build houses. These sites that I tend to dig, they're still there. They're on a farm. They're on an active farm. The farmer has to be there. So in this particular case, the farmer is access is tricky, so it's it's in a remote location. It's a 5 minute drive up a very bumpy farm track. It's then a half hour walk from the farm track. So the farmer's just in this particular case, which I should say is a quern quarry with rock art and probably Neolithic polished stone axe sharpening or grinding points. The farmer just doesn't want lots of people on his farm attracted by the interest. So he's just concerned that if hordes of people try to gain access to his land, his farming operations, his business, his livelihood would be interrupted. And that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, the site is anybody can get to the site, but you would have to park something like an hour's walk away. In order to simply get there, you know, in one of the towns close by, and then walk in, there's just no free parking, so very tricky. So that's all that is. It's really just it's a courtesy to the farmer, who didn't want the location revealed, and because he didn't want to be overwhelmed by visitors. I don't think it's an unreasonable request. I mean, we're parking in their farm. In between their buildings and getting in the way of their farming equipment. And there's no way we could do the project unless we could drive and park on the farm.
Yeah, totally. I'm just, I mean, that is quite interesting. And obviously, you've been able to keep this up over this year, I'm assuming, from the Facebook posts. What's it like running a dig during a pandemic?
It's interesting. Obviously, the first thing to note is that it's all legal. It's all above board. There's obviously an ethical question, so we have to be very careful. So, you know, what the tiers are, working within the council area, not travelling beyond, face masks, lots of hand washing, physical distancing. It's actually, it wasn't bad. One dig we had to completely cancel because we all stayed away. So these digs, everybody is traveling from their own home to a place of work, in effect, to a location. And we're maintaining 2 meters distance all the time. Lots of hand washing. I mean, we never actually touch each other. We're outside. Obviously, of course, I can hear people suggesting, is this the sort of thing that should carry on? Why would we put anybody at risk? And what I'm doing with the digs, I'm taking the view that these are physical activity in much the same way as an organized walk. So rambling can carry on up to groups of 30 through the pandemic. So we're just doing the same thing. People are going for a walk. We're having a dig. We're socially distancing on the dig. One of the interesting things is actually easier for me is I didn't have to make any coffee. Normally I bring a big flask of hot water and I provide teas and coffees. We didn't do any of that because obviously we didn't want to share things that people might have been handling. So it presented challenges, but just as commercial archaeology carried on, so research archaeology could carry on.
Totally. Well, we're going to have learn a little bit more about kind of Stern's history and directly what kind of led to you writing about Stirling and after this short break. And we're back. You're listening to Modern Myth. I'm currently speaking to Dr. Murray Cook about archaeology and heritage in Stirling. So you have a book that's already out, which is called Digging into Stirling's Past. Have I got that title correct? I think that is.
Yes.
So can you tell me a little bit about that book?
Well, yes. I mean, this was just... It was going back to those principles. Stirling is a fabulous place. Prehistory is excellent. There were lots of books. There are lots of books written about Stirling. But it seemed to me they always missed the archaeology. They were very good on the kind of the last 500 years. They were very good going back to the Wars of Independence. So at a push, the last 1,000 years was great. But they didn't really cover anything below that. And I just thought, the thing about Stirling is that you can walk within 15 minutes from a medieval castle, you know, one of the finest Renaissance palaces in Europe, to a place where Bonnie Prince Charlie stood in 1746, to a place where Cromwell stood or Cromwell's troops stood in a siege, to a fort, a vitrified fort, to a medieval battlefield, to Scotland's best preserved city walls. And that list, those lines of superlatives just keep going on and on and on. So the book was an attempt to say, gee whiz, all this is just here in Stirling. All of it is literally under your feet, just round the corner. Here's how you find it, and here's what it means.
And I'm just interested, you actually now have a book coming out, again about Stirling. So why do you keep writing the same book over and over again?
Well, it's not the same book. So what had happened was I actually have probably six differing books, all at differing stages of completion, on differing subjects about Stirling. So the starting point is that I believe that Stirling is the most important strategic location in Scottish history. Anybody who wishes to invade or resist invasion does it at Stirling. So every army from Agricola all the way through to Bonnie Prince Charlie and Cumberland has to come through Stirling. So, you know, you have got Romans, Picts, different types of Celts. You've got Vikings, you've got Angles, you've got Scots, you've got Britons, you've got the Wars of Independence, you've got the various medieval campaigns, the rough wooing. You go through the Jacobites, you end up with a role, an almost incredible role in the Empire, where Stirling is this tiny, tiny microcosm of the British Empire, because it reinvents itself as a commuter town from Glasgow in the Empire. And simultaneously, while that is that's happening, all that money from Glasgow merchants, it's a military barracks. So the cemeteries, the houses are all full of people who were entwined in that much bigger world. And then you move forward because of the kind of central connections, because of the transport links. The only way north-south was through Stirling. You know, so prior to the building of the fourth rail bridge, everything went through Stirling. So we have these massive communication network, which then, and the massive military base, means that you end up with things like the Atlantic Wall replica, which is was used to help help prepare the ground for D-Day, you know, which is the largest amphibious invasion in the history of the world, possibly one of the most important events in world history, you know, the end of the Nazis. So all of that is there, all of the this incredible history, this incredible network of connections. So there are endless stories to be told about Stirling, endless accounts. I think as well, if I could blow my own trumpet, there are certainly people who know far more about lots of things. I do think I'm quite good at communicating these things. I think I can say them in a way that isn't intimidating, that's quite fun. So it's a way of actually going back to taxpayers, going back to members of the public, communicating to them why Stirling is so significant and why Stirling deserves to be visited again and again and again, and why it is so central to our identity and our history.
So I'm trying to think about the place that this has in terms of public heritage and understanding. I mean, my view is that, unfortunately, the public have been shown the menu of history, and everybody orders what they're used to, right? So the person comes and orders a chicken korma every single time because they know what it tastes like, and they like the taste. Now, I feel like a lot of archaeology and a lot of heritage and history is kind of off the menu. You know, it's an off-menu item. But it could be just as tasty to a lot of these people. So I'm wondering, what is your opinion about people's knowledge of Scottish heritage? And what do you see as the kind of the what are the holes in understanding? What are the things that might be missing?
I tend to agree with you. I think there is a difficulty in that if you ask people about their past, certainly in central Scotland, the things that come to the fore are World War II and mining. And these are very visceral, important things that, that connect people to their local community. But there is a poverty of knowledge about that deeper past, about just, you know, the fact that there have been people living in these locations for 10,000 years. So I think that we end up in a self-fulfilling prophecy, that we tell people the stories that they know because they know those stories. So we tell them the stories that they know, and it goes round and round in circles. It's somewhere like Starling. There is always a difficulty. There is no one story here. And hence why there is no one book. There are stories about Romans. There are stories about Vikings. There are stories about the Picts. There are stories about Robert the Bruce, about William Wallace, about the world's oldest football, about the world's oldest curling stone, about the rough wooing, about empire, about slavery, about the global dominance of the British state through the 19th century. And actually, how to unpick those, how to navigate a general member of the public, what are they interested in, what are they not interested in, what should they be interested in, how to be entertaining and educating without being patronising, without deciding that this is correct history and this is not. How do we deal with there's a chap I've been reading about. His father is a covenanting minister. He's Blackadder. I don't know if that's the inspiration for the program. His dad dies in jail in the Bass Rock. So he's an enemy of the state fighting for personal freedom. That sounds very good, but of course that personal freedom is white and Protestant. His son is a slave owner. His son is a virulent anti-Jacobite, stops Jacobite troops during the 1715 and actually becomes the embodiment of the establishment. But he's, as I say, he's a slave owner. So, his views on freedom were celebrated. And as the state shifts around the 17th to 18th century from the Glorious Revolution and Catholicism, Protestantism battle with each other, that the right for personal freedom, the right for religious expression clashes with empire, clashes with personal freedom for slaves. I mean, these are very complicated issues. We're struggling with them today. The only way to deal with any of these things for me, I think, is to actually learn about them, digest them, and see what we think after a period of reflection. Some horrific things were undertaken. And just as we are transitioning from slavery, we embrace child labour through the 18th century. And there are accounts of 7-year-old minors working around Stirling. And that wealth is built, that builds Stirling, builds Glasgow, Edinburgh, all these places. What do we see when we look at the Victorian suburbs of every Scottish city? Where does that money come from? And what do we think about it? And that past confronts us if we choose to kind of look into that a bit deeper.
I think you're getting incredibly woke here, Murray. I think this is just a politically correct history ruining the real history, But this is the interesting part, I think, is I think out of the three things that you talked about, learning about something, understanding it, and then reflecting on it, I think we're possibly in the public eye, we're kind of missing on the last two of those things. And I think you've highlighted really, really effectively, because the end of slavery, wasn't suddenly a utopia. Because even the year that slavery was ended, that took a while to kind of spread out. And I think it's really interesting because I have this feeling as a non-Scot that Scottish history is sometimes, there's a little bit of whitewashing going on, especially when it comes to empire. And I find it really interesting how people relate to that history and that heritage. Do you think that people in general in Scotland, from who you've talked to, do you think that people are getting better at understanding their history, or do you feel that there's more that heritage professionals can do. Even if heritage professionals are the one to do it.
Well, I think we can always learn more about our past. And certainly I wouldn't wish to castigate the empire too much. Ultimately, what happens with the empire is that we were just better at doing nasty things than anybody, than all the other nasty people. The first written record of Stirling, which dates back to the 12th century, includes a reference to serfs, and serfs being transferred as property from the king or by the king to endow a church. Now, are serfs slaves? And there is a question of precisely the legal status of a serf, but our very earliest written record contains the unfree. So all of this is extremely complicated. There are no black and white issues. Robert the Bruce, great champion of Scottish freedom, clearly adjudicated on law cases involving serfs. William Wallace is a brilliant man, an absolutely incredible man. How more successful might he have been if he was a member of the aristocracy? Was support withheld from him by the aristocracy because he wasn't of the right sort? Certainly, without going into too much detail, the peace treaty of 1304 specifically excludes Wallace and a handful of others. We know by this point Robert the Bruce is back in Edward the First's good terms. He's surrendered. We know that the leader of the Scottish resistance, the Red Comyn, who Bruce will eventually kill under a flag of truce on holy ground, we know that he signed the treaty. These two guys are quite happy to serve up Wallace on a plate. Wallace's capture is made a specific term of the peace treaty. The powerful are the powerful. And they will always exploit, they always have exploited the weaker. It gets extremely unpleasant in the 17th and 18th century when we do that on the basis of skin colour. So the past is horrible. I mean, the past is absolutely horrible. Yes, there are interesting things to learn about. There are interesting buildings. The recovering the remains of these lost societies, these lost generations, the archaeological evidence is a kind of very poor, mute substitute to the living, breathing history or the kind of dialogue or the accounts, these individuals, but it's what we have. And it's, I think it's all the more precious for it. I think we all have to do more. I think heritage professional, I think if anybody is lucky enough to be employed as a heritage professional, they have an obligation to sell themselves, to kind of proselytize for the profession, to make everybody realize how important it is to recover this past so that what we do with it, of course, do we learn from it? Do we acknowledge it? There's a question of we have to learn from history in order not to repeat previous mistakes, clearly. Archaeology is fun, but it's not the NHS, it's not the police. It is one of the bells and whistles of a civilized society. So we have to fight to ensure that we remain civilized, to fight to ensure that people recognize the importance of the past, the importance of learning from the past, the importance of archaeology.
What do you think one takeaway is from people who have that kind of direct connection with archaeology? I'm kind of getting at the idea that, you were saying about the kind of people come on your digs are usually, students or those interested in heritage. What do you think I personally very much enjoyed my time when I very briefly worked as a commercial archaeologist for a very brief amount of time. And I thoroughly enjoyed the wet, windy weather, the digging stuff up, the getting absolutely muddy. It was really enjoyable, and I'm kind of wondering, like, what do you see as the physical benefit that people have from directly interacting with the past?
Well, I think the benefits are manifold. You're getting outside, so you know, at the moment, vitamin D is in short abundance in Scotland. So getting outside, getting that sun on your skin, meeting people, meeting new people, meeting people who want to be there, who are sharing a common aim, you know, that sense of camaraderie, of esprit de corps. These are brilliant things. Learning a new skill, being physically active, getting dirty. Is there some kind of benefit from being regularly exposed to soil as a boost to your immune system? I'm sure I'm healthier for having been knee deep in mud and dirt for years. I think, you know, the idea that citizens are contributing to the understanding of their past. I mean, if we collaborate in one area, do we encourage collaboration in another area? Is the principle of people actively taking control of research, of actually getting so involved, of learning new skills? So, I mean, for me, that commercial side, that if we want to actually learn about the past, we have to dig it. And we can wait for research grants, we can apply for the funds, we can do all of those things, or we can find four or five like-minded individuals and go out and dig it. I mean, obviously, everything has to be done correctly. You have to have the permissions, you have to have the money to publish the remains, you have to research them properly. But if we actually empower our fellow citizens to engage in researching the past, how much richer do we become as a society? How much richer does the record of the past become? All of these things are just there. They're just there for the taking. We have, Scotland, Britain has a very open system, a very liberal system with regards permission to dig on archaeological sites. Anybody can do it. We want to pay attention to the ethics. We want to make sure it's done. But the fact is that you could come to Stirling next week and you could help us at the secret site. You know, you could do that. There's nothing, no law to stop us. We're just going to have fun. You could do an hour, you could do a day, you could do a week. But you would be doing something vital and tangible, and you would be making a contribution to that kind of shared passion, that understanding of the past. That's what I think archaeology can do. And indeed, the type of archaeology I do is directly aimed at doing that, getting the citizen, getting the taxpayer to actively engage with their past. I can't think of anything that's more fun. Well, I can, but, you know, we've got to be polite.
Yeah, that's a great place to stop for a break. And we're back. You're listening to Modern Myth on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And in our final little segment, I think that this is going to be a little bit more laid back and not as strong as what are the political ramifications of doing archaeology in society. But rather, let's kind of like open things up a little bit more. It seems as if archaeology is a big part of your life, which is probably an understatement. But do you like engage in like archaeological media? Do you like watch TV series? Do you listen to podcasts? That's the real question there. What kind of stuff do you kind of absorb in terms of like heritage media, or is that a no, I'm off my work now, I'm off archaeology, I've done my reading today, I'm going to go and watch some cricket or football or whatever. What's it like for you?
I would say that I have some kind of mental illness. Yes, please don't take that the wrong way. I live, breathe and drink archaeology. I get up at 6 o'clock most days. I start work. That includes the weekend. I just constantly work at it because it's my hobby. And again, I get into trouble occasionally with fellow professionals because I can't believe I'm lucky enough to be paid to do my hobby. Now, I'm also, I don't really watch much archaeology on the TV because I either think they've done it wrong or I'm not particularly interested in the period that they're covering or there's so much padding in all of these things. So I like doing it. I like reading about it. I like writing it up. But I do it to extremes. So honestly, I can think of nothing more fun than going outside and putting a hole in the ground in the sun. I don't like doing it in the rain. I don't like doing it in the rain and the cold too much. But honestly, I sometimes have to pinch myself. I can't believe how lucky I am to be doing the sort of thing that I'm doing. And every day I wake up and it's another day and what am I going to do? And although saying that, I mean, I do, you know, I like walking, music, all the kind of normal things that normal people like to do.
Yeah, of course, of course. I would like to know, obviously, Stirling's known for a lot of its big history, big monumental history, like, you know, the Wallace Monument, Stirling Castle, stuff like that. Is there any kind of aspect of history, I'll say physical history in Stirling, that's kind of maybe smaller and less well known, but still really important?
Well, yes. I mean, there are lots of things like that about Stirling. It has this kind of ancient fabric. So there are places where, and again, the language here is, I have to be careful about it. There are places where confessed acts of witchcraft took place and are still standing. So obviously, I don't believe in witchcraft. And I believe that any confession from a 17th century witch was either the product of torture or some kind of mental illness. These things stand. And another thing, if you wander around Stirling, you see there's lots of the borough symbol, which is very important. And the borough symbol is a bridge, and it has a series of figures fighting over the bridge. This is an ancient borough symbol. It's recorded in 1296 on the Ragman Roll when people from Dunbar had been fighting against Edward I, surrendered and recorded their allegiance with the impression of the borough seal. Now, there is a Latin phrase around it. I won't repeat it, but the translation, and bear in mind, so we're talking about the late 13th century, but presumably we're talking about a symbol that is 100, 200 years older, which might put it into the 11th century, perhaps. The Latin motto refers to brute Scots. Now, this is interesting. This means that in Stirling, at some point in whatever we're going to talk about, the 11th, the 12th century, they didn't think of themselves as Scottish, that Scotland was to the north, that this was a different place. This had a different identity. And when we actually look at the periods under concern, so those kind of early kings, the sons of Malcolm III and Margaret, so Edgar, Alexander, David, we find that their charters are in three different languages and they are referring to a clearly multi-ethnic kingdom. There is, and without going too technical, there is Alapa, the Gaelic kingdom of Scotland, north of the Forth. There is England, which is the Lothians, or the part of England that they're controlling. And then there's Strathclyde, which is British. So Scotland, as we understand it, is 1,000 years old, less than 1,000 years old. And at that very dawn of history for Stirling, they were at that critical juncture, that crossroads that linked the three disparate parts of mainland Scotland. And of course, that's not talking about the Western Isles, That's not talking about the Northern Isles, all of which are probably under Norse control, still under Norse control at this point. So this concept of Stirling as a kind of a monument, as a symbolic place that links what becomes Scotland. And slightly further down the line, we find Scotland's first national assizes system is founded in Stirling in 1180. There had never been a national court system. So the birth of Scotland, the birth of the identity of this, what we consider to be our modern identity, is very much tied to Stirling, and it comes back to that geographical record. It's the only way north or south, there is no other place in Scotland where so much blood, so much treasure has been shed to control such a small place.
Excellent. So if people are interested in the work you've done, where's the best place that they can find out about it?
Well, I suppose the Facebook page, Stirling Archaeology, is as good a start. If people want to join in, then if they put a note on that page, I have a weekly email that goes out that talks about lectures, books, free things, digs, walks, and that gets sent out once a week, and everybody is welcome to join that, and you just pick and choose what you want to come along.
Nice. And obviously, so the Anvil of Scottish History, that's due to come out soon.
That's out today, actually. That's out today. Oh, yeah, St. Andrew's Day. My publisher thought it was a good marketing wheeze, and that is a history of Scotland through a Stirling lens. So everything from the Ice Age through to the to World War II, actually.
All right, okay. I mean, this episode will be going out after St. Andrew's Day, but I'm quite interested, right? So obviously, I grew up in Northern Ireland, so St. Patrick's Day is very, very important, and everybody celebrates it. What's wrong with St. Andrew's Day? Like, why is everybody like, oh yeah, is it really that day again? What's the problem with St. Andrew's Day? Why does nobody celebrate it?
Well, I think it's part of the problem for me is that clearly St. Andrew's relics are not in St. Andrew's. We're just looking at a piece of medieval spin. St. Patrick's real. I mean, St. Andrew is clearly real too, but St. Patrick is a real person with a real visceral connection to Ireland. St. Andrew is a piece of medieval spin, of propaganda designed to elevate Scotland at the kind of European courts. One of the things about medieval politics is that if you're not in the Bible or Roman sources, you're not really a real place. And there's always a struggle to justify small European nations on the northwest. And actually having saints is quite good. So St. Patrick's quite a good saint. St. Columba's a good saint. But St. Andrew is one of the kind of, one of the key players and closer to Christ, so therefore more important. So if his relics are here, then Scotland must be a real and important place. I mean, you find this in the Declaration of Arbroath, which makes references to Roman literature, Roman history, but also contains this idea that we're founded by the daughter of a pharaoh. So we're an ancient, warlike people with a place at the table. And to be fair, this is merely in response to Edward I trying to justify that Scotland wasn't a real place and had no right to an autonomous existence. So it's medieval propaganda, personally.
Wow.
So I'm not quoting Stirling Castle here, obviously.
Okay. In your own capacity. Well, yes. Thank you very much for sitting down and letting us know a little bit more about the heritage of Stirling. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
misconception you held dear. They told you what you wanna hear. Why can't you see that the truth will set you free? Expose this modern myth with me. A myth. Modern myth.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.